Travolting presents Bobbin for Robin, hosted by Jeff Sweeney and Stuart Elmore. Covering the world according to Garp. Enjoy the episode.
Garp.
All right, so I got one thing to say to you, Stuart.
Garp.
Garpe diem.
Garp.
Anyway.
Oh, garp.
Garpe diem.
Arp. Arp.
All right, Mr. Hot Fuzz.
Arp.
Yarp.
Yarp.
Garp. Garp. Garpe diem is all I wanted to say to you.
Garpe diem. Welcome back to
Garp
Bobbin for Robin.
Yes.
The only podcast
covering the career
of Robin Williams. Yes. There's no other podcast doing it.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to our episode last week on Popeye. I am what I am.
I am what I am.
Everybody knows this.
Yes.
But we're picking up right now with Robin's immediate pivot after Popeye.
Yeah. This is his quote unquote third movie, but like, I think,
can I do it to any glasses? Well, like, does it count?
As we talked about like on the Popeye episode, like even his managers are like, I can't believe he had that fucking movie under his belt. And they kind of regret that.
Yeah.
So Popeye is his spiritual.
It's got big Stallone Italian Stallion energy.
Yeah,
I think we talked about this on the Can I Do It to Any Glasses, where Stallone was in the porno and they re-released it as Italian Stallion after Rocky.
It's exactly what happened. So like Popeye, according to Robin, his managers and all that, is a spiritual first movie, which would make...
Spiritual first movie, such a funny sentence.
Spiritual first movie, which would make The World According to Garp his spiritual second movie.
Yeah, but it's his third movie.
We're counting. Like, you know, just take that for
what
you
really
will.
Funny to say Robin Williams started in a like softcore porn college campus movie.
College campus sketch show.
Sketch show.
Yeah. So, yes, we're covering 1982, directed by George Roy Hill.
Yes.
The World According to Garp.
Which, we've covered a lot of movies on the show.
We have.
And there are very few times where I have been as confounded by a movie as this.
Interesting. Like, we've not talked about our... Jeff, you just can't got over. I had to fill in some context. Like, I definitely do my homework early.
Yeah.
We've not shared a single word about our receptions to these movies whatsoever.
Yes.
What do you think of World According to Garp?
That's the thing is, like, normally we watch these movies.
Yeah.
And, like, I like it or I dislike it. It could be, like, weird or confusing, but usually I'm able to figure out, I kind of know what the movie was trying to do, and then it either succeeds or it doesn't.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure what the end goal here was.
I'm in the exact same boat with you. I was watching this movie.
I was truly confounded by it.
Just to spoil it, the very end was what like really shook the core for you, right? You're like, what the fuck is this movie about?
because
it kind of defeats the whole purpose of what's been going on in
because
the movie.
Ostensibly, this movie is like Forrest Gump-esque. It's like a decade before Forrest Gump, but it's like, it's the story of, what was the tagline for Forrest Gump? Like, the story of a man or something like that. The story of a lifetime. I'm looking up the Forrest Gump poster because I really want to pull this quote. The world will never be the same once you've seen it through the eyes of Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
This movie is called The World According to Garp.
Pick a special person.
I'm seeing the world through the eyes of Garp. Except I'm not really convinced I am.
You're not really like, seeing the world, though, because like a lot of the things that you're quote-unquote seeing are fake.
Yeah.
Like, you're going through second wave feminism.
Yeah.
But it's not like there's no like real life things that are happening.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It's like if Forrest Gump was attending a bunch of fake events.
Well, and so I should say...
And wasn't
like,
funny.
The World According to Garp is based off of a John Irving novel.
Yes.
By the same name, which was published in 1978.
The novel is like semi-autobiographical.
Yes.
Very loosely.
Very loosely.
Because it's John Irving's mother. He did not ever tell him anything about his father. And so he would have to come up with stories about who his father was.
Yeah.
And that was like the beginning of the concept of this book.
Yeah.
That went on to become a huge bestseller. Was a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction, and just like was kind of a moment.
Yeah, well, I would say like the one thing that people would say about this movie, especially in the early development stages, is how non-adaptable this book is.
Yes,
for a couple of reasons. Number one, like because of its like subject matter and its modem storytelling, how it's really through the eyes of Garp. But like his mom is a figure through it, and sort of it's a lot of interior narratives being told in Garp in this book, and then it's also the fact that there's quite a lot of things that you couldn't put in a movie in 1982 in this book. Like I think the movie waters this book down a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit. Like they keep the Ellen Jamesian whole thing, which. When I looked into like the book, there's not like too many differences.
Yeah.
But there, I from what I've understood and what I read, I don't have specifics. There's a few other things in the book that were like it's no wonder no it adaptation has put the orgy scene in the movie, right? It's like kind of in that sort of vein, but, not but obviously in that crazy.
It's also my understanding that the novel is very, it's a very fragmented narrative, and so like. It'll be what the movie is essentially adapting.
Yeah.
But then there's also chapters that'll just be Garp's fictions that he's writing.
Yes, yes. And so
chapters from his books, essays he's written.
Which thinking
and
about
so you're
it
so much
now,
in the character of Garp.
Yeah, thinking about it now, like this, I don't think this isn't as unadaptable as what people might be thinking it
is. Time has definitely made this like seem more adaptable.
Yeah, I think there maybe with newer technologies and newer forms of cinematic storytelling, there's a way to do it, but I think like, so anyway, let me dive into the Robin context of this all.
Yes.
So last week we talked about Popeye, which is a very monumental moment for Robin to star in the movie comedy musical Popeye. 1980 Popeye. Just say that.
I am what I am.
But it really was.
Eat your spinach.
But this is also a monumental moment for Robin because this is kind of his first movie after Mork and Mindy goes off air. Which is a big moment for Robin. So as we talked last week about Popeye, it's, you know, that movie comes out in 1980. That is through Robin's, the height of Robin's fame. And we mentioned this. It's like Robin has such a quick, almost like John Travolta-esque, where it's like he has a quick, sharp rise to fame with Mork and Mindy. But he's also like becoming, he's using the fame of Mork and Mindy to catapult his stand-up comedy fame.
Yes.
Hence why we're getting these HBO specials, which are becoming monster successes. So he's kind of using these two
parallel tracks.
Tent poles to like hold up his like fame. And so that all then creates the perfect storm for his managers when they're thinking, okay, but his managers, and I say this a lot because like Robin is the kind of guy where it's like, especially early in his career, he's so different from Winona. Robin is the Ron Burgundy. He'll read anything from a teleprompter kind of a guy.
Yeah. And he'll make it funny.
And I mean that in the sense of the jobs he picks.
Yeah.
I've read this book already, but I'm reading through the second time, but I can tell you already right now that a common thread in this book when Robin picks a role.
Yes.
Is no matter what, he somehow makes it about himself.
Mm-hmm.
He like relates something in the story that, oh, that's kind of like me in my childhood when we moved to Detroit.
Yeah.
Or, oh, that's kind of like me with my mom and her quirkiness, how she and it's like, you're talking about Bicentennial Man.
Yes.
It's like, it's like that's literally the thing in the book that like, I like love him to death. Right. It's like, he talks about some of these movies, which are like, not in his wheelhouse whatsoever, but he somehow, when he jumps onto the movie or does press for them, he's always talking about how like, oh yeah, like when I went into this, like I felt like this connection to the role in this kind of way. Whereas Winona, as we've mentioned, like she's very particular about her role.
Yeah.
She's very smart. She's very Robin. And I circle all this back to why I bring up his manager so often is because Robin is just like, his managers tell him, hey, this is the movie you're doing next week. Copy that, boss.
Yeah.
Like, that's just Robin's, like, modality.
Yeah.
Like, he's not thinking about, like, what movies are coming down the pike and stuff unless there are no movies coming down the pike.
Yes.
So managers are thinking, like, okay, let's get him his first movie. What's it going to be? It's Popeye. He does Popeye.
Yes.
We, as Popeye. As we talked about, Popeye does not do so well. But he's still got Mork and Mindy.
Well, the thing about Popeye is it does well, but doesn't do as well as they're expecting. It's like a very weird, like we talked about, but it's very weird.
Yeah.
Popeye for like the mod, it like makes three times its budget and everyone's like, flop, Robert Altman, no more movies for you. Go make plays in Paris with John Travolta. It's like, it's really weird. It's really weird.
It like, is very weird.
It'd well, be like if, you know, well, nowadays, I'm, like Steven Spielberg made a movie and it made, you know, three times his budget and they're like, eh, not big enough.
Well, and it's also very mixed reviews in, as we talked about for Robin too. It's like, is this guy going to like characterize himself as a cartoon, like a character actor, like cartoony character actor?
He's playing a cartoon.
Yeah. And so this is 1982. This is towards the end. This is, I think this comes out when the during the last season of Mork and Mindy. Mork and Mindy just gets canceled, so it's not coming back. And he's already had two of his comedy specials come out, if I'm correct. No, he's just had his first comedy special come out, the HBO comedy Off the Wall. That one just came out. And he might be in the process of recording An Evening with Robin Williams.
Yes.
To all that degree. So he gets approached to do A World According to Garp. And obviously right out of the gate, it's like, oh, this is a very serious role. Mm-hmm. Like, this is going to be like an actual acting thing. And Robin talks about how it's like, this will be great because I have to like bring up my Juilliard skills.
Yes.
and have to be an actual like actor for it. Like, and he's interested in that. Well, so he shows up to set and it's directed by George Roy Hill. And as we talked about, like with Popeye, also I've mentioned with Mork and Mindy, like Robin Williams, and he never loses this, is an improviser.
At heart,
he likes going off book. So you can imagine the reaction to Robin when during the first take, the first scene of the day, early in their shooting, he goes off script and George Roy Hill calls rap.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm not fucking with that. Go home, everybody. Robin's like, oh shit, okay.
It's crazy as hell.
He's like, I am not, I like George Roy Hill like has said in multiple interviews, I did not stand for his improv. Yeah. Except for when it was funny.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. When it was funny. And we're going to, this is what I think is interesting about The World According to Garp, which is going to cover a lot of this first act of the show, is the comedian problem here.
Yeah.
Which is Robin has branded himself as a comedian and a cartoon character. How is a director going to take somebody coming from that establishment and mold him into becoming an Oscar winner in Good Will Hunting? Like, how do we get from that to that? And this is one of the very first, I would say, personally, non-successful attempts.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Robin has a few moments in this movie, but you and I would probably both agree, like, he's going up with Glenn Close, who's also her film debut.
Yes.
And John Lithgow. And one of these three does not match.
Yes.
And it's definitely Robin.
Robin feels very, you know, this movie is kind of about castration in some ways. And his performance feels very, like, neutered.
It is.
I don't think he's bad in this movie by any stretch. I just think, like,
you feel it.
Yeah, I'm like, let me see a more intro. Let me see someone. Like, this movie's called The World According to Garp.
Yeah.
The first thing I'm going to assume is that it's funny.
Yeah.
It's not very funny. Because that's a funny title. His name is Garp.
Yeah,
that should be funny, right? Like that.
Well, but
call it like The World According to Sean. I don't know if it's gonna be like boring. It's not boring, but
there is a different, like, I mean, it is a very serious book, very serious topic. This is coined as like an American drama comedy.
Yes,
but it's very much a drama. I mean, I think it's all to say that it's like it's very. Robin is miscast. Robin is very miscast. This is.
I wouldn't even say he's miscast. I think he's misdirected.
I think that's he's miscast. I think he's miscast. And the reason why I think that is because I don't think at this point in his career, he has the scope to do Garp in high school to Garp as like a dying man.
Yeah.
Like he does not change in the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, he doesn't. This needed a Dustin Hoffman, really.
Yeah,
I think that's,
Hoffman would have been good.
Yeah,
I mean, the thing about Garp is a word we're just gonna have to keep fucking saying. Is that Like, I do think Robin has, like, that kind of bright-eyed, you know, innocence that mm-hmm. this character needs. And there are times where I think he does lock in. And I think a big part of it is going to be what you said about George Roy Hill, where it's like he doesn't let him go off book.
Yeah.
And Robin's just very constrained. And when he's constrained, he's not very effective.
Yeah.
Because, like, I do think that he has the look and he frequently has the right personality for this character. And it just not... It just doesn't, like, sing through it the whole movie. And George R. Hill's just, like, a weird case because...
Yes, George R. Hill.
He directed, like, two all-time seminal classics, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Sting.
And both then, of which are box office failures, though.
Are they? No, I mean, he gets the best director, right?
Well, I'm saying they're not popular at the time. They take...
The Sting makes $257 million on a $5 million budget.
Well, what did I read somewhere that was like, George Roy Hill was thought of like, he wasn't appreciated at his time.
He was appreciated, and Butch Cassidy was a bit... He had been like kind of on a flop run for a little bit.
Okay, maybe that's what it was.
Because like those two movies are massive hits. And then, oh, actually, maybe not. You know, I'm looking and... Slaughterhouse 5, The Great Waldo Pepper. That is a great title for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think he just kind of had like a short run of success.
Okay.
But like he's in a big period right now. He'd written like two of his movies were like Butch Cassidy was one of the biggest successes of all time, along with The Sting. And then like he's making this. He kind of comes in with some clout as a two-time Best Director nominee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he does run the show, and there's merit to if you want to keep the script the way you got it.
Yeah.
But I think it just neuters Robin's performance in a way that makes him kind of boring throughout the whole movie. Like, there's the sequences where he's allowed to have a little spark, like when he's running up and down the what do you call them? The seating at a stadium. He's running
bleachers.
Up and down. Bleachers, that's what. He's
yeah. Oh, sorry.
He's like running up and down the bleachers with Helen there reading the book. And every time he passes her, he like says something. Like, it's very funny. It has like big Robin comic energy to it.
But that's the thing. It's like, I think I only disagree slightly in the sense that I don't think this called for a Robin Williams in this role. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think it's very, like.
I think the good version of this movie did.
You think so?
I think so.
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's because of how much it doesn't work for me. It's like, I believe it's like, maybe Robin isn't right for this movie. But I also think it's like, even just hearing you say, like, I think this would have made it funny. It's like, I don't think making it funny would have helped the movie. Yeah. I think you needed somebody to like, you said innocence. And I thought that's the best word. And Robin is a good characterization of innocence, except.
Like, look at the poster for this movie.
Yeah.
It's Robin Williams smiling. It says Robin Williams is Garp. He's got a funny way of looking at life. And there's a house with a plane crashed into it right below.
Yeah.
Him.
Right.
Like,
which that, is a good scene in the movie, by the way. That's a good scene.
Selling such a different movie than this is.
It is. It is.
This is not.
It is.
This is not a movie about like a funny, innocent, wholesome guy who's walking around life and you're seeing life through his world.
Yeah.
What this movie is marketing itself as is Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
Which is why I keep bringing up Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
A movie that is like kind of like crazy and evil, but it more successfully manages the tone that this is looking for. The key to Forrest Gump and why people like Forrest Gump, it's not people don't like Forrest Gump just because of the boomer nostalgia. They don't like it because of Jenny, and they like it because Tom Hanks is funny. That's why people keep going back to that movie, because he's very funny in that movie.
But
people like to say, "Mama,
why is he funny?"
Because he's funny. Because like he's allowed to be funny.
No. What's funny? What's funny?
The way that he delivers the lines.
Right.
Yes.
And is that character present in the world according to Garp?
No.
So like the question I'm asking is like, what you're laughing at Forrest Gump, what would that translate to what you're laughing at in the world according to Garp? Robin just being Robin? Like,
yes.
I guess I'm only saying this because like I agree with you. If the world according to Garp was closer to Forrest Gump and it had Robin Williams, 1,000% agree. Mm-hmm. 1,000% agree. I just don't think it's like this movie is not.
Movie doesn't know what tone it wants. It doesn't know if it wants to be serious or funny.
And that's ultimately what
I'll have some slapstick shit like when he's falling off the gutter and the dean's running and he gets hit by a flying gutter.
Exactly.
That's really funny. I thought
it is
I laughed.
Very funny. Yeah.
But then there will be like 30 minute sections where it's just like.
But then he talks to
the driest shit you've ever seen. But
Robin then goes on this like monologue about like radical toxic feminism.
Yeah, it's like half.
And it's like, what are you trying to be?
Yeah,
guys?
What is this movie about? Where like the last 30 minutes are about Robin Williams trying to take down feminism.
Well,
but also it has a trans character. With it's I really don't. That's the thing that's confounding because I have no fucking idea what this movie's trying to be about.
I guess in a one
is
good
he
way,
the villain of the movie.
Well, the thing is, it's like on a broader
Garp kind of sucks. I'm gonna say it. Garp, the character, like he kind of got what was coming to him.
I think the character sucks from the movie. Again, yeah. I've not read the novel, nor have I even done that much research to the novel. It sounds like this, the character of Garp is supposed to be like a victim of bright-eyed innocence with early on anxieties that throughout your whole life think are going to come true.
Yeah.
And because of that, you end up manifesting them to become mm-hmm. true. That's like, I think what John Irving's whole like point with yeah. Garp is supposed to be is like throughout your whole life, you've had these anxieties about what's going to happen to you when you get older. And because of that, you sort of just manifest them happening.
Because like my great take about Forrest Gump is that I think Forrest Gump is the villain of that movie. And I think the movie is kind of aware of this.
That's Jenny?
No, Forrest Gump is the villain.
Jenny?
He ruins Jenny's life.
Jenny ruins his life.
No, think about Jenny.
All right, hold on.
The problem. No.
Go.
You know,
cook.
To me, the thing about Forrest Gump is that I kind of read Forrest Gump as he's like this symbol of like just American like power, just constantly steamrolling forward, bright eyed, innocent, not really paying attention to what's going on around him. And he just goes through life. He goes through life like a feather in the wind, not trying to change anything. He's just like, I'm going to go figure things out. And then he's just walking through. Jenny is an active character who is trying constantly to better her life and trying to figure things out and make changes after growing up in an abusive childhood.
Hmm.
And you know what she accomplished? Know what happens to her? She is punished by the movie for this. She is punished for trying to see things out. Forrest Gump is a piece of shit. Who should have been shot. No, I'm kidding. That's not true.
But you believe that.
But I do think Forrest Gump is like just emblematic of American idiocy.
Hmm.
And just like how he's like, I'm going through Vietnam. I'm walking around. I'm just going to run from one side of the country to the other. And like he makes no active choices. He's just walking through life, letting things happen to him. And he's rewarded for it.
Why do people love the movie then?
Because it's funny. And they're like, a bunch of people like buy into that American sucker attitude of, if I just go through life, like good things will happen.
What do you say to people? We should have this corner. It's worth it. Yeah. What do you say to people who think, I mean, partly me, what Jenny's a piece of shit.
No, Jenny's great. Jenny did not deserve anything that happened to her.
Jenny literally toys with Forrest's heart and then just ditches him and
I
only comes
I
back
that,
when it's
I
convenient.
I think that's a sexist read.
You think it's a sexist?
I think
read?
That's a sexist read.
Okay, what's your take? How is it?
Because the thing about Jenny is that she doesn't want to keep coming back to Forrest. He keeps seeking her out.
What?
That's the movie.
She arrives at his doorstep at the end of the movie, bro.
Yeah, at the end of the movie.
Yeah, but when she has cancer and is going to die.
When she finally realizes that she's not going to be able to accomplish anything in life because she's been seduced with AIDS.
Right, which, but like, I'm not saying, like, of course, like...
The problem with Forrest Gump is it dislikes, is that it will just be Forrest Gump walking in and just, like, disrespecting the Black Panther Party, the counterculture movement. All these, like, movements that were trying to instigate change in America that Jenny is emblematic of. And Forrest Gump is just like, sorry I ruined your Black Panther Party. Which is, like, a little funny, but at the same time, like, it's just incredibly disrespectful. Like, that movie is evil. And that's why I kind of like it, because I think it knows it's evil.
Interesting. Interesting.
Like Forrest Gump is
just... I
was going
to say, I feel like that is part of the joke.
Forrest Gump is, like, the clean-cut white American idiot who has everything handed to him and never has to fight for anything in his entire life.
Hmm.
There's no point in Forrest Gump where he's down and out.
I won't disagree with that.
Even when, like, he's the only shrimp boat that survives.
Yeah.
He's the one guy who makes it out of Vietnam and all he has is gets shot in the butt.
Yeah.
While his black friend dies.
Yeah.
And sends his family into poverty as a result.
Yeah.
His big loss is...
He sends some checks.
His big loss is his mom dies at one point. And then the girl who he loves dies because he basically abandoned her.
He abandoned Jenny?
He kind of abandoned Jenny. Jenny is like failed by the movie because she's a poorly written character. But I do think that Jenny, like in Forrest Gump, is ostensibly just like the punished person.
Can I say something? I agree with you on some part in terms of Jenny's like sexist take and poorly written, because there is a part as I'm rethinking about my viewing of the movie where I'm like, yeah, fuck Jenny. She kind of like you almost want to say it's like she did all that stuff to herself. And then it's like, oh, but wait a minute. That is kind of like the bad take on it.
Yeah.
Because if you think that, then what you're saying is that everything that Jenny like went through in life, including her turmoiled upbringing up into her going through like counterculture and drugs and sex and all that stuff, is like all her own choice. And she's only a victim
Jenny
of herself.
Never gets the help that she needs.
Right.
Because she's failed by America. She's failed by this country.
To that point, though, like, I think they're like, in terms of just like the writing of her character, however you want to like question it.
I'm
not
going to. Jenny is very poorly written.
Right. And I'm just saying it's like there's like, it's hard to disagree that like when she shows up again at the end of the movie and she's on her deathbed, and it's like, it's just like it's another yet another one of those moments where it's like you're literally coming here because you know like Forrest loves you and will take you in and take care of you. Like that is what you're doing here. And like and then she doesn't tell him until like until she has cancer that, oh, and by the way, this is your son.
Yeah.
Like
Jenny has to, at the end of the movie, stop worrying and love the bomb, which is the problem. Like with it's like the tragedy of that movie is that she's someone who's trying to not conform to like basic American, you know, standard. And at the end, like literally as she's dying, she's like, I just have to fucking settle down with a man.
And you know what?
Which sucks.
And like, you know what?
That's like,
that is almost kind of the attitude you want in T.S. Garp Robin Williams.
Mm-hmm.
You want a guy who's growing up with a very feminist mother.
Yeah.
Who's feeling conflicted about all these weird things.
Yeah.
I honestly think the first half of this movie, kind of okay.
It's fine. Yeah.
It's pretty good.
It's like fine.
I actually like the scene where he's in the diner and it's the sex worker and Glenn Close.
No, that's a good scene.
That's a great scene.
Glenn Close, great.
Glenn Close is, she got an Oscar nomination on this
first
movie. Yeah, first movie.
Albert Nobbs herself.
Yeah. And but like, I think there is a good point to this movie where it's like Garp is growing up with this like very feminist mother who like doesn't think like, I just want a kid. I don't need a man, which is very like non-traditional at this time. It's like, you're intentionally putting your kid through a single parent household. Like what are the ramifications of that? Like, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
Yeah.
Like all those cool things. Then seeing all the results of that through Garp.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, what kind of views is he going to grow up with this like sort of experiment, you might say, that Jenny Fields is doing? And like to kind of like you mentioned, it's like Garp kind of sucks because he almost is sort of like an anti-feminist sort of guy. And you have to think to yourself, wouldn't a feminist mom raise an anti-feminist?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that kind of make sense?
Yeah, because you rebel against your parents.
Right. It's the same thing. It's like, why would, if Christian parents raise an atheist, it's like, doesn't that kind of, isn't that self-explanatory?
Yeah.
Like, so like, but then the movie like doesn't do anything with that.
Inherently, like the problem with that is that like Christian parents raise an atheist. Like if you ask a Christian, obviously they'd have a different take than me. But like but the point of that is like, that's not really that bad. Like it's not like one of those sides is inherently correct. It's two different viewpoints on
talking about Christianity.
Christianity versus atheism. Like inherently.
Yep.
Both those people are heading in the same direction of life.
I see what direction you're going.
They're heading in the same direction of life.
I see what direction you're
going. Feminist versus anti-feminist. There's like a correct side in that battle,
but
I would say.
Here's the thing, Jeff. It doesn't matter what, you know, you take concept and the results of using the concept.
Yeah. No, I'm not.
It doesn't matter
the
results. It matters how much you're emphatically emphasizing like the concept onto son, daughter, student, whatever.
It's
and
like,
so the fact that it's like, it's literally just like vegetables, bro.
Yeah.
Like everything is good about eating vegetables, but what happens to kids when their parents,
they don't eat vegetables.
They don't eat vegetables
and
they know it's good for them.
Very much like correct.
So I think like with the feminism thing, it's like, I want to see a Garp growing up and be like, and it's like, oh, like, you know, Garp, don't you think like women should finally have the right to like, so-and-so? It's like, sure.
Because like, the story that ostensibly this scene, this like is basically trying to tell. If I were to like, if you gave me this story and you told me write this, you can change the ending if you need to. I would keep most things the same. Garp should like have his rebellion against feminism. After his mom dies, he should like have something of a come to Jesus moment.
Like what most kids do when their parents either get old or pass away.
Yes.
I mean, as you get older in general, you find out your parents are more correct than you thought they were as you were younger. So I agree with that sort of.
Instead, it has like, after his mom dies, he becomes even more radically anti-feminist because they won't let him go to her memorial.
How do you write that scene where they're telling him he can't go to the funeral without him reacting that way?
Well,
or I guess reacting in a way that's more palpable. Because I only say that because I watched that and my takeaway wasn't that he was anti-feminist, that he was anti-toxic.
Well, here's what I'd say is that if I'm writing, I don't have that scene in the movie.
Okay.
The thing is that scene is put there to service an agenda. Later in the movie. Like when you're rewriting a movie, people are like, well, how do you rewrite this scene? I'm like, well, I just don't include that scene.
So you don't include the part in the story where the women don't let the son go to the funeral.
Yeah. Like that, you know.
That does seem a little bit like, come on.
You put that there
to service an agenda.
How you want the movie to go.
Yes.
Like, I just wouldn't have that scene there.
And it is kind of like stupid.
Yeah.
It's like, we're only going to allow women to go to this feminist, like. Like, I don't know. And this isn't like this. I'm going to get chewed out in the comments here. Like, is this second wave feminism in the late 70s, early 80s? Is that what am I completely wrong on that whole thing?
I will be very frank with you. I am not quite sure.
Like what?
Because it's a fictitious movement.
Okay, second wave feminism, 1960, 1980. So this is roughly around like, this is.
Because it's a fictitious movement in the movie. It's like loosely based on second wave feminism, but it is
but
like
it's not real. And that's the other bullshit of the movie is they make up this Ellen Jamesian's whole thing. And I think that is the worst part of the movie.
Yeah, because the idea that the like what they're trying to do with the Ellen James side is like actually there's an interesting idea there, which is like they all cut out their tongues.
There's a woman named Ellen James
who had her tongue cut out because she was raped by two guys and they cut her tongue out so she couldn't tell them. Like
identify them. Yeah.
Which is like silly. You could just look at a picture and point, but like you could write it down on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Whatever. Rapist or idiots. Whatever.
That guy raped me. Yeah. You could write that. Down. Yeah.
But like a bunch of women cut out their tongues in solidarity. And like, I would just say like, that's an idea that like can be explored where it's like performative activism.
Mm-hmm.
That's like an interesting idea for movies to explore. It's happened plenty of times.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think this is the movie to do that?
No.
With feminism, written by a guy, directed by a guy, starring a guy, about a guy named Garp. Like, and I don't know. I don't think that's
I agree with you. And to even further push that point, it's like they're relating this whole thing to a radical fundamentalist religion-esque thing. They literally call it mutilation because they're paralleling this with genital mutilation, which is like the radical belief that forces you to mutilate yourself.
Yeah.
And they're putting that on a feministic, like
you know,
fictitious icon.
You know, it's a good version of this idea in the movie The Nice Guys, 2016, Ryan Gosling, Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
There's like the part where they're looking for Amelia and they find that she's in like a climate advocacy group and they go to City Hall and there's like 30 kids pretending to be dead on the steps of City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this funny scene where they're trying to like identify a person in this group of fake dead kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all wearing gas masks. And Russell Crowe's like, the gas masks didn't help with the pollution. And it's like just a good joke about performative activism.
Yeah.
And it's funny and it like kind of, you know, pokes the right holes.
Yeah.
Without discrediting the larger idea.
Yes.
That's the first thing that came to my head. There's better examples, I'm sure.
Yes.
Whereas this, it's like, this doesn't use a scalpel. This uses like a machete.
Yes.
To come at it. And it just, we should probably go back to the beginning and kind of go through this a little more.
Sure. Yeah.
But I just think that this movie doesn't know what it's doing. And like, there's a great bit of context that John Irving did not write this movie. He wrote the book. He did not write the movie.
Yeah.
And he was originally asked to write. The movie is written by Steve Tesic.
Yeah.
He was originally, John Irving was originally asked to write this movie by George Roy Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up not writing it because Irving had envisioned the character of Roberta Muldoon, played by John Lithgow, who's a trans woman. John Irving had written her in the book and in his conception of the movie as a much more of like an empathetic character of like, oh, this is like a former Philadelphia Eagles player who's now a trans woman and is like going through the struggles of that. And George Roy Hill thought, that's funny.
Mm,
that's like a funny idea.
Yeah.
Philadelphia. And like, I'm not going to say that it isn't. And the book has a sense of humor about it, but it's much more interested in that character's story and empathizing with her.
Yeah.
Even as we're like, you know, we're having laughs along the way. The exact quote Irving said was, it was the early 80s when George Roy Hill asked me if I'd write the screenplay for Garp, but I knew we didn't see eye to eye about Roberta. George was a World War II guy. He couldn't see past the comedic part of a transgender woman who'd been an NFL player. A pity, because John Lithgow, who is cast as Roberta in the film, could have played her as I wrote her. Roberta is a force of normality in an otherwise extreme world. She's the only character who loves Garp and his mother equally, the only character who isn't in a rage about someone or something. I declined to write the Garp script because George wouldn't do Roberta my way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think every problem we're discussing about the movie is
Senders to
in
that
sentence.
Yes, I, yeah. That
is that
very well
George
said.
Roy Hill was just like, I don't know, women.
It's a dude who's now a girl.
Yeah, he's
it
like,
was a football
it's
player.
It's a little funny, right?
Yeah.
And just that there, its movie lacks the empathy it needs to criticize.
Did you not like want to like throw up the scene where like John Lithgow tackles a guy and it's like, you know, that's just like, oh, we're going to make this transgender woman tackle a guy because it's a big brawl. It's
yeah.
Like, and I just like watch that scene. I'm like, I want to throw up.
John Lithgow gets an Oscar nomination for this movie.
John Lithgow's great in this
which
role.
Which is a little crazy because I don't think like
John Lithgow definitely doing
think,
some like,
I think John Lithgow good is quite good in this movie.
John Lithgow is a great
actor. It's one of those like crazy things where like they would nominate someone for, the reason he is nominated for an Oscar in this movie is probably just because the Oscars want to really celebrate John Lithgow for being brave enough to dress like a woman in a movie. And that's not to discredit his performance, but I do think that there's a part of it that it's just like, John Lithgow was so brave.
To dress as a woman.
To pretend to be transgender in this movie. And we're going to honor him for that. And there is some merit to that being like the beginnings of recognizing trans people in movies.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'll give you the applause when a trans actor is nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
For playing a trans person.
Yeah.
Or even not playing a trans person. Just playing a normal person. Like, or no, I shouldn't say normal. Playing like a man or a woman who's not trans. Just played by a trans character.
I hear what you're saying. Like, trans can play cis, cis can play trans.
Yeah.
Like, gay can play straight, straight can play gay. I'm of the viewpoint that anybody can play anybody.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Anybody can play anybody. Except if there's like the only thing I'm going to say is like, how should I put this? Like, you're going to have to really fucking sell me on a white dude playing Rosa Parks.
Yeah, of course.
Like, you're going to have to like write a 80-page novel selling me on that idea.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to say, like, 100
to
0.
It has to be like Bubba Hotep, where they have the black guy play JFK.
Right.
And it's just funny.
But you know what I'm saying, though? Yeah. It's like, my philosophy is anybody can play anybody,
but
there are roles
it.
That where you have to, like, every casting requires some form of justification, hence why we've talked this long about Garp.
Yes.
And there are certain roles in certain casting combos that you're going to have to like put a bigger argument into justifying. So to that point, Jeff, did you think John Lithgow was good in this movie?
He's good in the movie, yeah. I don't think he's worthy of an Oscar nomination, but I think he's good. Interesting. I would nominate Glenn Close for an Oscar. She's great.
She was nominated for an Oscar.
I don't think John Lithgow has that much to do in this movie. He's like good in his scenes, but like it's not like he has like a really because George Roy Hill didn't give a shit about his character that much.
I was in your modality, what you're saying right now, until you just said the trivia bit about like John Irving not wanting to write because he didn't see eye to eye with George Roy Hill.
Yeah,
and I hear you say that.
Yeah,
and I think, oh my God, that makes John Lithgow's performance even better because
he's bringing an empathy
to that role that probably wasn't offered by a director.
Yes.
He's probably doing a lot of that character formation on his own doing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like,
yeah, that's like,
I think that's great.
It is great. And it's just like, but it's just like, he doesn't have that much to do in the movie, is the
But
thing.
As you said, with, like, from John Irving's point of view, yeah. like, and I think John Lithgow does a great job yeah. of like, correct, like, in a way, like, conveying that whole, like, listen, it, Robin Williams even says it. It's like, I know the punch, there's a punchline to his fucking line that's yeah. stupid, but like, Robin Williams, he says, like, you know, Roberto, like, you're the most, like, normal person out of all of them. And then, like, the punchline is, oh, yeah, I was a Philadelphia football player.
Yeah.
And now I'm a
Go
woman.
Birds.
And it, and then Robin has this, like, gorge, like,
yeah, you know? It's like, boing.
Yeah, it's like, it is like, it, the has, like, that fucking punchline, like, ring a bell joke moment yeah. to it. But
yeah,
I think the skeletal framework of that character is still, like, John Lithgow is trying his, yes, his no, best to preserve it in the movie. And that, and I appreciate it. And I see it. I see it in the movie.
This is also just a crazy time for John Lithgow where he's like in this, he's playing the assassin in Blowout.
Dude, literally this is 2 years after he plays yeah. the assassin in Blowout. Yeah.
Great year. Great time for John Lithgow.
Is it crazy that like season four of the show, we're back into like sort of a parallel actors,
parallel track. Yes.
Parallel track with John Travolta.
Yeah. Because we're going to talk about him again at some point.
We are. And it's going to be interesting because I never thought of like Robin and John being like time period wise, like kind of parallel.
Well, Popeye is responsible for Basement's the Dumbwaiter. Basement's the Dumbwaiter doesn't happen unless Popeye flops or I can't even say we talked. I can't say fucking fly. I made so much money and they were just like, nope, not enough. Send him to France. And then John Travolta was like, hey, I'd just like to be in this Basement's the Dumbwaiter movie. That's just fantastic.
you want to... Oh, one last bit of context.
Yes, and I have one other bit. We'll eventually
you,
get to
You go first.
I just want to say, Roger Ebert's review for this movie, I think, is like...
I think in capital...
I think it's exactly it's what exactly, we're thinking.
Yeah.
I'm entertained but unmoved. A palatable interpretation of the novel. Well written. Yet cruel, annoying, and smug, which is like such an incredible like summary of how I feel about this movie.
Well, and I thought the acting was unconventional and absorbing, especially by Williams, Close, and Lithgow. I would remove Williams from that. I don't think Williams, I thought Williams was being as conventional of an actor as you could possibly be. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I thought the visualization of the events by director George Roy Hill was fresh and consistently interesting, but when the movie was over, my immediate response was not at all what it should have been. All I could find to ask myself was, what the hell was that all about? Which
is
exactly
it.
What I walked away with the movie. I'm like, what was that all about?
Janet Maslin is the New York Times critic, said it was a fair rendering of Mr. Irving's novel, similar strengths and weaknesses. The novel was picaresque and precious, so is the film. Although the absence of the book's self-congratulatory streak helps the movie achieve a much lighter, more easygoing style. Pauline Kael, there's no feeling of truth in either the book or the movie. A generally faithful adaptation seems no more and no less than a castration fantasy.
So, can I go on a little rant here?
Yes.
It's just like the whole like Ellen Jamesian castration thing is, I'm going to get political. I'm going to get political here for a second because nothing pisses me off more than like the false radicalization of your opponent's idea.
Yeah.
And I think that and that's something that is happening in this movie with this Ellen Jamesian plot bit.
Yeah.
Maybe John Irving is doing something interesting with that, but the movie does not. And
yeah.
it really made like and like when the movie has an end with Ellen James actually shows up in the fucking
yes.
movie. And like, thanks Garp for like, you told my real story.
Yeah.
And like, you told the truth of my story, not what these women are doing with their, you know, removing their tongues castration bit. Like, you're doing me justice, a man who wrote a book.
Sir, have you ever played, I swear to God, this has a point. Have you ever played the video game Bioshock Infinite?
No.
Okay. So I'm going to describe to you the plot of Bioshock Infinite.
Okay.
We're not going to talk about the multiple worlds. Like, there's a lot of fun ideas in that game.
Okay.
But the core of it is, like, you go to a floating city in the sky called Columbia, and there's a, like, dictator named Comstock who's running everything. And he has his, like, his soldiers and whatnot. And there's a rebel group called the Vox Populi that are trying to overthrow Comstock. and they are all low class workers, most of them of color. Okay. And halfway through the game, you help the leader of the Vox Populi overthrow Comstock, and it succeeds.
What's the name? Comstock.
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 Comstock. Not Comstock. You help them overthrow Comstock. And then, like, due to various events, you have to kill the leader of the Vox Populi. And then the second half of the game, the Vox Populi become the villains. And the rest of the game is basically you fighting low-class workers of color who have taken all of the fascist weapons and are now using them against you. And you're just, like, mowing through Krasnoy. You're like, this feels bad. This is, like... And, like... There's like it's trying to make a political point, and it just he's completely flopping on his head to make this point. And at the end, it's just like you stopped the Vox Populi from really just becoming their enemies. This is not what point we're making here. It's not succeeding. It's not what we're trying to do right now. Which right. is the same way I feel at the end of this movie, where Ellen James shows up saying, "Thank." Well, she doesn't have a tongue, but she's like, "Thank you for telling my story and telling it to the feminist that I'm the real feminist." And I'm like. Folks, can we just not? Yeah.
The only last bit of context I want to share is that this movie made Robin Williams want to be a dad.
Yeah. And then he has Zelda.
And then Zach.
Oh, is it Zach first?
Zach's his first child with okay. Valerie.
Yeah. Should we do a special episode where we play all of the Legend of Zelda games
just to honor
get in his mindset?
Yeah. I have no more context.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's all the context I have. We've also very much I summarized a lot of the plot already.
Yeah. I mean, we can.
Yeah. But I do think it's worth
movie starts doing with the baby's a penis.
Yeah, it starts with a baby's penis. It's playing the Beatles. Would you love me
yeah.
when I'm 64?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is nice. It's a good
Jenny
song.
Jenny Fields just gave
Jenny.
Birth. Just
I love you, Jenny.
She is kind of serving.
I'm gonna mow the lawn, Jenny.
Glenn Fields is kind of serving like Jenny energy in this movie, mm-hmm. which makes it more closer to the fucking Forrest Gumpy bit that you were yeah. talking about. So she just had a child, and her parents don't approve because it was out of wedlock.
Sir, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I just want to say, did you know that they almost made a Forrest Gump sequel?
I did know that they almost
and
made
that
a Forrest
they
Gump sequel.
Canceled, that they were about to announce it, and then 9/11 happened, and they said, well, Forrest Gump is not relevant anymore, and canceled it.
Forrest Gump is not relevant anymore?
Yeah, they said that they would Forrest Gump would somehow have to cope with 9/11. And they're like, we just cannot do that in this fucking movie. And canceled it
the
immediately.
The joke fucking writes itself, where they're just like, yeah, I saw this really nice building. And then when I came back next year, it wasn't there more.
It would be, and then some man flew a plane into that building that I like so much. Mama always said that people would do crazy things. I don't know why. The actual joke in the movie is that he would have a ticket for like flight 93 and then he'd miss it due to some crazy mishaps in like a taxi in New York.
And I missed my flight yeah. and I heard that flight didn't make it to the other side.
They didn't make it. Like that would be what would happen. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because I don't think we're going to talk about Forrest Gump again in this episode. So I had to get that out there.
Okay.
One day we're going to do a Forrest Gump episode. It's going to be 7 hours long. It's going to be crazy.
It'd be crazy. Wedlock son, she says like the dad is not in the picture. He's dead. He was from the war when she was a nurse and she goes and lives her own life as a nurse at a school.
Yes.
Is it like a prep school or college?
It seems to be like a prep. It's like a prep school for boys.
Okay. Yeah. That's what it sort of felt like. She names him
somewhere in the Northeast.
Yeah. She names him T.S. Garp.
Yes.
After the dad.
Yes. Technical Sergeant.
Technical Garp. Sergeant Garp. Robin Williams will say the joke that like, what does the T.S. stand for?
Tremendously sexy.
Tremendously sexy or tremendously sad at the very end of the movie. And basically, like, Garp's being raised at this all-boys prep school with Jenny Fields, Glenn Close, and as Garp is grow, like the first, like this is a 2 hour, 16 minute long movie.
Yeah.
Much too long. Much too long.
Yes.
Or at least like it needed to justify this runtime yes. way better. Because like by like.
It thinks it's an epic, but it's mostly set at like three locations.
Yes. Yes, it is. And so like the first 45 minutes of this movie is Kid Garp. I don't think yes. we get Robin Williams till like the 40 minute mark.
It takes a while for him to get there.
Yeah. And so he's growing up at this place. Garp is, what do you even say? Like just like, cause he gets like his feminist influences from, Jenny. She'll say things like, I'm trying to think of like she'll catch him looking at a young girl.
Yeah.
And she'll like see like lust. You're trying to,
which is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's like a funny bit.
Yeah. And so, but, and she's not like sheltering him, but she's definitely like, I don't know.
She's a very controlling mother.
Yeah. Very controlling mother. And very observant of like his mannerisms and his yes. ways. And, then Robin gets into the picture. He's grown up. He's in high school.
Yeah.
I just breeze through the first 40 minutes of the movie. Like,
We also need to talk about the scene where he, is playing with his friend Poochie. Is that her name?
No, Cushy.
Cushy?
Cushy.
Normal name. Yeah, that's typically what we name our kids as Cushy. I don't know why I said Poochie. That's the dog from The Simpsons.
Good.
He died on the way back to his home planet. Do you know that bit?
No.
Poochie's like a skateboarding.
I don't care.
it's a skateboarding dog in the cartoon within the cartoon in The Simpsons.
This is great.
They hire Homer to voice Poochie, but his performance is so bad that in the episode, the first time he appears, it just freezes, and then they drag his cell off the screen, and then a hastily written thing says Poochie died on the way back home.
Great.
I wanted to talk about that.
So basically, there's one scene where he's a
Robin
kid.
Robin Williams Simpsons episode. Should we cover that?
That means we have to do the Robin Williams Law and Order SVU episode.
No, but
episode.
We're only going to do the Simpsons.
No, we have to do the Robin Williams SVU episode.
I'm looking at Robin Williams' page on the Simpsons wiki right now.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Okay, stop it, Jeff.
No, this is nuts.
Okay, that's...
It is just a picture. It's like him as a Simpsons character.
Oh my God, the hair.
It's him as a Simpsons character. Gender, sex, male, status, deceased, hair color, brown, occupation, actor. The only things it says about him and that... is that he's in a dream of Homer's that Stanley Kubrick wanted him to star in The Shining. Lenny dislikes him because he was eating dinner with his kids and didn't reference his movies. Death. On August 11th, he committed suicide by hanging. It's crazy. That's the Simpsons wiki page for him.
That's great.
It's nuts. Who wrote... Whatever.
Whatever.
He's in high school.
So, well, first I missed the bit where it's like he wants to fly. He has all these yes. imaginations of his dad,
yes.
who he doesn't know anything about. All he knows is that he was a pilot in the war, World War II, and that he wants to fly. So he has all these fantasies. There's one really cool sequence where we go into like his drawings.
Yes.
And it turns into like this animation.
I thought
sequence.
That was going to keep happening in the movie. This is fun.
That should have been like a reoccurring bit.
Okay. So here's what I'm thinking at this point in the movie.
Yeah.
The movie's called The World According to Garp.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're going to have the contrast of the real world, and then we're going to get like Garp's visions and dreams and whatnot displayed through like his various artistries, whether it's, you know, his drawings or his books or whatnot.
Yeah.
Which seems to be kind of what the book does.
Yeah.
But then this is the only time that happens. Except for it happens once more where we go inside of one of his stories later. But that's it.
Yes.
It only happens twice.
Yeah.
I'm like, why is it called The World According to Garp?
If we're not seeing the world according to Garp. Yeah. So
this is mostly the world according to the people around Garp, and he is present.
I want to talk about the scene where she describes how he was born.
Yes.
Because it's very done.
How he was conceived or born?
Conceived.
Okay.
So like Garp goes onto the roof.
Yes.
Because he pretends he's a fighter pilot.
Yes.
And then he slips and he nearly falls. This is like kind of a slapsticky bit right here.
Yeah, because
the gutter hits
the dean who's like, get your mattresses.
Yeah, he's about to fall off the roof. He's screaming for his mom. Glenn Close runs up the stairs, is on like a little walkway path just underneath where he's at. She's like, I'll grab your leg. Garp falls off, Gutter falls down, hits the Dean in the head. She does this fucking iron fucking grip on Garp's leg. Yes. Doesn't let him fall. Like,
she's got him.
She's got him. But then he's in the infirmary, and so is the Dean. The Dean's the infirmary. And then Glenn Close tells the Dean the story of how Garp was conceived. She's like, whoa, why is his son just named Garp? Or why is your son named Garp? And it's like, well, you see, when I was in the war, there was a fighter pilot who got in a really bad plane crash, and he suffered severe brain damage. So they brought him in to the infirmary where I was taking care of him. Mm-hmm. All he could mutter was the word Garp. Yeah. Garp. Garp. Those are the only things he could do. But he also had a massive erection. Yes. That would never go away. And so one day I'm thinking, I'm ready for a son.
Yeah.
But I don't want a father involved. And this is the perfect specimen.
Yes.
So one night when everyone's asleep, she takes him on. And then at the end of it, she said it was very quick. And then his last words were good.
Yeah. And then he died.
And then he died. And that's how he, and then the Dean is like, you raped a brain damaged man.
And she's like, I don't know.
I don't know about
and
that.
The movie never delves into it again.
Nope.
We just say it.
Garp is there for the whole conversation.
Yeah. And he's like,
Garp is now aware that he is a product of rape.
Yeah. And, and his father was a brain dead pilot, who would come back from a raid over Germany. Anyway, this movie's just weird. That's the and like not in the good way.
Not in a good way. So
like I just watched all of David Lynch's movies. Those are weird in a good way. We're trying to figure out what's going on here.
We also,
and this, I'm just like, what's going on here?
We also missed the bit where he's a kid and he like is going to have sex with Cushy and they're two kids, but then the dog bites him in the ear.
Specifically, she's like, I know how babies are made, and he's like, how? And she says, you come in and I say, I'm having a headache today. And you say, you always have a headache. And then you jump on me and rip my clothes off.
Yes.
And so that's what they're trying to do when the dog attacks him.
Yeah.
And we get the recurring bit of Cushy's little sister. What's her name?
Pooh.
Pooh. Normal. Who was like watching them through the brush and sicks the dog on them.
Yeah.
And then Pooh keeps coming back, lurking in the background. Eventually she kills
Seemingly
Garp,
has so a grudge against Garp.
Yeah.
For some reason.
Because she's a radical feminist.
Is that what it is? She was just jealous because Garp.
She was jealous. Yeah. And then the movie basically conflates it like, well, she was jealous that her sister was with Garp. And so she became a radical feminist and then shoots Garp.
Got it.
Good. Normal.
Good. Good. Great. So we're at Robin Williams. He's in high school. By the way, 1982, you know how old Robin Williams is? 30.
Yeah.
Robin Williams is 30.
Yes.
I guess that's a key difference is that...
He looks about 30.
John Travolta in 1980 is...
Just like, fantastic. No.
He's like 20, right?
Yeah. He's in his early 20s. Let me figure out. I'll figure out how
I should actually...
I'm figuring out.
Yeah. How old was John Travolta in 1980?
He's 26.
26. So he's 28. So he's actually not that much younger than
Robin.
It's
like 2 years younger.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking because like in 1980, he looks like kind of a good 30s, like sort of. John Travolta does in Blowout.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but I only brought that up as Robin being 30 years old when he's playing this second movie. Because 1980, for Popeye, he's 28, probably 27 when they're filming the movie. And I don't know. It's just something that I wanted to bring up because, like, Winona's making her first movies when she's 16.
Yeah.
Right? John Travolta makes Saturday Night Fever at 19.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Robin Williams doesn't get his, like, career start until, like, late in the game.
Yeah. Well, it's because he's in TV and stand-up for a little bit. But even
still.
But
he doesn't even start that until he's, like, 25.
Yeah.
Like, Morgan Mindy, he was, I think, 26 when he really gets into it.
Yeah.
It's because he went to multiple colleges and dropped out.
Yes.
It really stunted it, you know.
He lived a bohemian lifestyle for a little
bit. He lived a very bohemian lifestyle for a while. And still did during the making of this movie. Yeah. And so, yes, he's in high school. He's in wrestling, which should be noted that Robin, when he was in high school and in college, was also a wrestler.
Yeah, so he
and really
experience.
Good, too. He actually competed in the state final his freshman year. but he said that the person he went up against was like a 7'5" behemoth bearded dude.
Good.
And that's who he went up against in the state finals. So Robin actually is a wrestler.
Wrestling.
And in this wrestling scene where he's wrestling a guy, he spots the coach's daughter.
Yes.
Helen Holm, played by Mary Beth Hurt. Who I think is great in this movie.
Yeah, no, she's good.
She's good.
She's actually maybe not Glenn Close the best performance in the movie. I was gonna say she maybe the best. No, Robin, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. But Mary Beth Hurt, amazing in this movie. Yes. And so they start flirting with each other. Glenn Close is like, she even goes to the coach. It's like, you know, our kids are lusting after each other.
Yes.
So
like, I don't know, lady.
But then Robin, they start a relationship, but then Robin sleeps with Cushy because they're like childhood sex friends.
Yeah.
Why?
For some reason.
I don't know. And then Pooh.
Helen sees it. Pooh tells Ellen, shows Ellen.
Shows Ellen. Helen.
Yeah.
And then Helen is like, breaks up with him. And this is midst of why he's trying to become a writer.
Yeah.
After the breakup, he's like, I'm going to go to New York and become a real writer.
Yes.
And then he goes to Glenn Close, his mom, and Jenny is just like, yeah, I think we should, let's go to New York. So they go to New York.
My kind of town. Now, New York, New York. It doesn't do that, but
yeah,
it should.
Yeah. And so while Garp is trying to become a writer, he's writing some short stories. Jenny is writing her own book.
Yes.
They're each like writing. And so she writes a partial autobiography called Sexual Suspect.
Yes. Which is, I want to say, a good title.
It is a great title.
That's a great title.
That's actually a really good title. Yeah. She sends it into her publisher and they're immediately like, this is the perfect time for this because it's going to send ripples and waves. So they publish it. Immediate success.
Yeah. She becomes like
a feminist
icon. The leader of the feminist movement, essentially.
Yes. She becomes the leader of the feminist movement. And she uses the proceeds to fund a center at her house.
Yeah.
But
here's where the movie, to go off what we were talking about earlier, kind of like starts veering in the wrong. Because the point it's making with this book is that she writes a book called Sexual Suspect. It's relevant for the times. And she becomes a feminist icon. Robin simultaneously has a book published at the same time called Magic Loves, or a short story.
It's just a fictional short story.
And it's like not really that successful.
Like it's a good book.
And the point, and then the movie basically makes the point of like, she was savaged by the critics. I wrote this lovely little story about a guy with magic gloves, but he can't touch anyone. And nobody appreciates me because they just want to be feminists. And it's like essentially what the movie is saying.
Yeah.
It's essentially the point it's making. I'm like, I don't know, buddy. Sorry, your short story didn't sell.
It is like very much like a woe is me.
Yeah.
Like role that he has to play in this. Like
it happens. Sometimes you write a short story and it just isn't a success because something else is more popular.
Right. Listen, now, when I wrote my short story, my mom became a feminist icon. I too was a little disgruntled.
it happens to all of us at some point.
It really does. You just kind of have to work your way through it. And so then,
like, if this was that he and his friend went to New York at the same time, and his friend Reich wrote some trashy horror novel, and that became a success, like, sure.
Well, brother.
Then you can do this story.
Brother, Robin Williams did go to New York with his best friend who became an overnight success. And that person is Christopher Reeves, who gets in Superman in 1978.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, that is like, it's
sure.
It's a little funny.
Yeah, a little funny. A little.
Robin is the Juilliard dropout and Christopher Reeves is the shining success story.
However, only one of them was in Superman 4, The Quest for Peace. So.
Only one of them was.
When's the last time you looked at the poster for Superman 3?
That where he's carrying Richard Pryor.
Yeah, where he's carrying Richard Pryor. Did we talk about this already?
Yes, you show it like to me on a daily basis.
The best poster ever.
It is great.
Where it's like, Richard Pryor's like, why am I? Why is he like, Superman's carrying me? What's going on? Great.
I should say I did watch. I'll just say it on air. Last week I watched the Christopher Reeve documentary.
Yeah,
very good. I cried 7 times.
Yes, you did. what's that called? Super Slash Man, right?
Yes, Super Slash Man, the Christopher Reeve story.
Yeah.
And really good. Everyone should go and watch it. It's on HBO Max. Mm. And Robin is like a titular side character.
They're best friends.
Yeah. He's in it a lot. And yeah, it's good. So they had to move back to the Northeast because she opens up this like home for wayward women at her old house.
Yeah. She opens up a home for wayward women, and he and Helen, who is
get back together.
Who suddenly is fine with him after he hands her a short story, even though he was cheating on her.
We don't have a good sense of time in this
movie.
Yeah,
we don't.
Because Robin doesn't age. Glenn Close doesn't age.
Yes. But Glenn Close gets like a little wrinkly at one point.
A little bit. A little bit.
But like he goes back and he gives Helen a short story and she's like, it's great.
It's great. It's so sad.
And he's like, well, you said you would. Sorry. He said you would only marry a writer. And she's like, I did say that. And he's like, I'm a writer. And she's like, yeah. And the next thing you know, they're buying a house together. I'm like, so we're fine with him cheating on. Like, I'm fine if you want to like get over that. That's fine. You just kind of.
But they don't even talk about
it. You should have a scene where we talk about it at least. Because it's going to become relevant again later.
They don't
cheating
talk.
On each other.
They just don't talk about
yes.
it.
Yes. And so they move into a house that gets a plane crashes into it when they're touring it.
And he's like, this is perfect. We'll take it. And they're like, what do you mean? It's like, well, just think about it. A plane crash just went through it. Statistically, when is the next time a plane's going to hit it? Never.
See, that's the kind of thing where it's like, you think this whole movie is going to be like
that.
Garp seeing the world like this.
Yes.
And then it's just like, doesn't happen again. Mm-mm. There's like a whole subplot of him like chasing like a guy down because he keeps driving fast through the neighborhood. And it's like funny.
Yeah. But like,
what are we doing? He's just getting angry at everyone.
Yeah.
Which is, if that's the point of the movie, then make that the point of the movie.
Yeah, I wonder if there's like an actor who could have taken that same script director and like zhuzhed a little something more. That's just why I don't think Robin was great for this role.
Yeah, like Dustin Hoffman would be, I would be interested to see that version of this movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then his mom starts becoming more of a feminist.
Yeah.
But her home becomes a home for other women.
Yes. He helps other women get over their troubles.
Yes. But she finds out he goes home, visits Glenn Close, meets Roberta,
yes.
John Lithgow, was transgender woman.
Yes. But it has nothing to do in the plot. So we probably won't talk about that much because she just like is present in a lot of scenes about other people.
Yeah.
There's not really like a scene in this movie that's the Roberta scene.
Yeah.
She's kind of like there.
She tackles a guy and then carries Glenn Close after she gets shot.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But those are about the only big things I can think of when it comes to John Lithgow.
Because normally it's like Roberta will show up to in it like some scene that's between two other characters.
But like talk about range.
Yeah.
He just killed some people as an assassin 2 years ago. And now he's
John Lithgow's great. He's Lord Farquaad himself.
Yeah. He's amazing.
Stuart, you should watch Conclave.
Yeah,
you would love Conclave.
I would.
Conclave is big Stuart Elmore energy.
Why?
That movie is about a bunch of like veteran character actors, like Ray Fiennes, John Lithgow.
I'm already like getting hard.
I'm trying to think. There's Stanley Tucci.
Oh my god.
Isabella Rossellini, just like all locked in the Vatican together, and they can't leave until they decide who a new pope is. Mm-hmm. Which sounds like kind of boring. But it's just like this kind of trashy, pulpy thriller about like all these like old queens kind of being sassy at each other as they figure out who the new pope's going to be. It's crazy.
Old queens being sassy.
You would love Conclave. You should really watch Conclave.
My good little atheist.
It has a twist at the end of it that you will not simply not see coming. And I'm not even spoiling anything by telling you this because they tell you at the beginning of the movie there's going to be a twist at the end. But you simply will not guess it.
Understood. When Garp goes to visit Glenn Close, he meets the first like Ellen Jamesian.
Yes.
Which is, as we talked about, like, you know, feminists who cut out their tongues in solidarity for Ellen James. And this is the first moment in the movie where Robin Williams' character is like, this is wrong.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are mutilating yourselves.
Garp just becomes bitter and angry.
Yeah. And so he's like, we should not be doing this, guys. So then we cut back to Garp and his...
Garp and Helen. Garp.
And they have two kids, one named Duncan.
The other named Walt.
The other name, don't care, he dies.
No. This is key. His name is Walt, and he's afraid of death. in case you couldn't tell what's going to happen next.
Right.
It's they make it so fucking evident.
They're obvious.
He's like, Daddy, what happens when we die? I'm afraid of death. I don't like thinking about death. He dressed up as death for Halloween and it scared me. I wonder what's going to happen to this kid.
Yeah. And like some of the scenes with Robin and the kids are good. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just like it. But Helen starts cheating on Garp with one of her students.
Yes.
Because she's a grad school teacher.
And is he cheating on her with the babysitter?
He does. There's a one night fling.
He seduces a babysitter.
With the 18-year-old babysitter.
Yes. Normal.
Very normal. And so he learns of Helen's infidelity, rushes home, grabs the kids, leaves. They have this whole conversation over the phone where it's like, you better break up with that guy or I'm not coming back to the kids. She's like, I promise I'll break up with him. And then she's in the driveway in the car with her student lover. She's trying to tell him, listen, we got to break up. And then in a very gross way, he's like, what if we just do one more time? And Robin explicitly says, like, you don't do one last time or anything of that bullshit. You just got to break up. Well, she performs fellatio on him. So that happens. Yes. And then while that happens, he's rushing home in the car, not knowing that they're parked in the driveway. And we established earlier that Robin knows how to like.
He turns the car off at the top of the hill so that he can like essentially glide the car home.
Yeah. He knows how to do it like basically eyes closed.
Yeah.
But he wasn't expecting the car to be there.
Yeah. So it collides in the car and the movie freeze frames on three of them. And zooms into Walt smiling. You're like, well, I wonder what happened
to that kid.
The other kid also loses an eye, so it's not like he gets out scot-free. But
and Robin has his jaw wired shut because like he
something happened. Helen has like a neck brace. Never explain what happened to the guy.
Nope. It does. There's a quick little scene where Roberta is walking Helen up the stairs. He's like, man, that poor student. I had my penis surgically removed, but I can't imagine what it'd be like to have it bitten off.
Oh, okay.
Like,
yeah, so that they do say that.
Like that was a John Lithgow performs that very, very well. That's a really good scene.
It's just like it's when we say this is a bad situation. Like this is like just a bad situation.
It's a bad situation. So like the only thing I think of is like Garp forgives Helen.
Yes.
And Helen forgives Garp.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like...
The problem here is the movie doesn't treat either of them with the guilt that like they deserve in this
problem.
No,
it doesn't.
It's like, he's just like, he keeps blaming Helen and everyone's like, Garp, you should be nicer to Helen. But then Helen also is like, Garp's so mean to me. Why is he so mean? And it's like, well, there's culpability on both sides here. I don't know.
Yeah.
You're both kind of responsible for this kid being dead. I don't know.
You are. So,
and then they're like, let's just have another kid. And I'm like, replacing him? What? What are we doing? You're not taking the blame and your son's like, well, we'll just get over it and have another.
Call it Walt 2.0.
This is crazy. This is like crazy. I'm like, what are we doing in this movie at this point?
So then after this.
Is this movie about how people in the 70s were weird? Because if so, I'll take it. If that's what you're trying to say.
I don't know, man. it's funny, the Wikipedia. It's like, as a result, Walt, who frequently foreshadows his fear of death, is killed.
Yes. Rip Walt.
Rip Walt.
Duncan loses an eye and gets a crazy glass eye.
Yeah. The only thing I could think of is like, they're like, Jenny goes to another like political rally.
Yes. For a governor.
And gets shot.
Yes.
And dies.
She gets popped.
She gets popped off.
Yes.
Because she's a very, obviously because she's a very divisive figure in society, you know?
Yeah. Well, and Garp, because he's so angry at the feminists, writes a book called Ellen about Ellen James.
Yes.
Critiquing the Ellen James movie. And he starts getting death threats.
Yeah.
And then Jenny is shot and killed. And
they don't want him to go to the funeral. The feminist.
Yeah, the feminist.
What feminist? They just broad paint stroke the women.
Yeah.
The women
don't want him there. I would also say, like, I understand it's your mother, but you did write an anti-feminist screed that you published mere months prior.
Yes, you did.
Like, I don't know.
Well, like
at this point, I'm just like, I'm checked out of the movie at this point.
Listen, technically speaking, he's the next of kin. He has rights over her corpse.
Yes.
Which means it doesn't matter what the feminists want. He can have whatever funeral he wishes.
Yes. Well, the thing is, he does have funeral. It's like a memorial service devoid of her corpse.
I thought her corpse was
It's
there.
Like a memorial service just for the movement.
Then why does he care to be there? But see, Robin,
he wants to mourn with people.
And it's such a bullshit and it's like, thing. Robin, no, you don't.
Here's the thing. Yeah, you get to mourn people. But you alienated all these people. Yeah. This is the thing. It's like the end of the Great Gatsby.
It's like how we make fun of Australians and White Castle on our show. And what? Do we expect to have a fan club get together and invite only Australians and White Club fans?
You said White Club.
White is, Castle.
Okay. Brother, this guy stinks! Oh my goodness. But like, it's like the end of the Great Gatsby where like Jay and allies are the only people who show up to Gatsby's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just like, well, he all these people just pretended to love him, but he had alienated them all. And I'm like, you alienated all these people. Did you expect an invite? Sorry. No. Like, yeah. But he goes to the funeral in disguise, in drag. It's weirdly the Mrs. Doubtfire outfit, exactly. Turns out this is a sidequel to Mrs. Doubtfire. The entire plot of Mrs. Doubtfire happens in the like
in the background.
In the interstitials.
But Pooh is the one that I did.
Winnie the Pooh.
And she immediately calls him out, and then all the women are like trying to like fight him.
Yes.
At one point, John Lithgow, in all of Roberta's glory, decks a woman.
Yes, it's very cool.
And it's
good for him.
It's good. Funny. And so he runs away, and then he's led away by this one woman who we find out is Ellen James.
But it turns out to be Ellen James herself.
And she thanks him for the book.
Yes. And very nice. See, he's the real he's the real feminist all along. All these women don't know what they're talking about.
What a story, Mark.
But he decides he's going to just become a wrestling coach.
Yeah, he decides he's going to be a wrestling coach and like leave politics.
It's like when Forrest Gump is mowing the lawns, except there's even less justification for it.
Yes.
At least in that, the town just offers him the job of mowing the lawns. I'm like, all right, it makes sense, I guess. And this is just like, he's like, I don't know. I'm going to go back to wherever the fuck I'm from and coach wrestling.
And he's in the middle of wrestling practice. And then Pooh.
Well, someone walks in, and the second someone walks in and starts walking towards him, I'm like, they're going to shoot him.
Yeah.
That's how this is going to end. And it's Pooh, and she shoots him.
With a pistol.
Several times.
So he's airlifted into the air in a helicopter with Helen.
Yeah. Which is actually a great shot.
It's a great shot. There's like a moment where it's like, did they actually shoot it inside of a helicopter going up off the ground? Because like the way the shot is structured is like they start inside the helicopter on the ground, but then the helicopter raises in the air and the scene still continues.
Yes. It's a good shot.
Fuck, that's like really good.
It's a really good shot to end this movie on. And he's like, I'm finally flying. And then he like flashbacks to being tossed in the air by his mother when he was flying then.
And then from the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, and then the end credit, and then you know the thing pops up where it says Garp died shortly thereafter. Helen was shot shortly thereafter by anti-feminists. His kids were killed in a car bombing by the IRA, and you're like, what?
Roberta is doing very
Roberto, well liked by all, lived for many more years. died of natural causes.
Got married, finally was able to adopt, and still fights for trans rights to this day. Like. Yeah. It's at this moment in the movie, I'm like, what the fuck?
What was this all about?
What are we doing here? The movie doesn't do super hot. I mean, we talked a lot about the critic reviews already and about how like it's very like lukewarm reception.
Yeah,
like, a lot of people agree that like, you know, good performances by actors.
Yeah, most people are like, it's fine.
But it's like the movie really falters in like what it's trying to achieve.
Yes, it does not have any control of itself.
And so From that, like, I have, you know, we had a budget of $17 million. It grossed $29 million. So it just a little bit under half of its budget earned back. It's like just a little under double.
Yeah.
So, like, it made most of its money back and maybe made, like, a small, measly little profit.
Yeah, it made a little bit of money. It's 2 Oscar nominations for Close and Lithgow.
Yeah. And, you talked about, like, George Roy Hill, you know, goes on to do, like, a few movies after this, but not many, because then
it's, like, kind of the tail end of his career. The beginning of the tail end of his career.
I think,
Don't forget, he ends with Eternal Classic, Chevy Chase, Funny Farm.
Yes.
Has anybody seen this movie?
I haven't.
Someone has seen this movie. Last line in the Wikipedia for Funny Farm, the 1988 Chevy Chase comedy. Then U.S. President Ronald Reagan viewed this film at Camp David on June
11th, 1988. Oh, my God.
This is apparently regarded by Chevy Chase fans as one of his best films.
Man.
I should watch Funny Farm. Sounds good. Reagan screening it at Camp David? Weird.
Funny enough, the role was first offered to...
We need to go... Reagan and Clinton broadcasted every... like. Published online every single movie that they watched while they were in office, mm-hmm. and with the dates. And we need to go back to doing that. I want to see, like, how many times does Trump watch Citizen Kane a month? It's the only movie he ever talks about liking.
The first president we get who has a letterbox changed the world.
Yeah. It'll be me. when I run for president. This podcast will invalidate me for running for president. So
this podcast will invalidate us from having a film career.
No, just for running for president. Uh-huh. Anyway, so yeah, this movie comes out like modest success. 2 Oscar nominations for performances, but I wouldn't call it like enduring classic in any way.
Yeah.
In the way that the book was at the time. Maybe I'll read the book and maybe it'll be good. Who knows? But I probably won't because life's too short.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else to say about The World According to Garp? I think we did it all, right?
Just, like I said, I mentioned, like, this is still in, like, the early stages of Robin's career where, like...
Yeah. What does this do for Robin? That's a good question.
It doesn't really do anything for Robin. And the biggest... I think one of the things is this is... I shouldn't say that. This is, like, notably Robin's, like, first failed, like, drama in serious role. And this... You know, he talks about, a lot of other people talk about that. It's like this being that this was Robin's like first attempt at The World According to Garp. Like, it's no accident that, you know, some of the movies like afterwards that we're going to be talking about are going to be more into the comedy realm. Like, I don't know much about Moscow on the Hudson, so I can't speak on like I. But I'm pretty sure he just plays like. A Russian, because that's like one of his bits in comedy.
Sounds good.
It's like
Stuart. You've actually convinced me that I'm gonna like that movie,
right?
By saying that
Rob. Well, you know, like Robin. One of Robin's biggest stand up bits is he does accents, and one of his common accents is Soviet Russian.
Yeah.
So like this movie like capitalizes on him doing that. Best of Times. Don't know anything about that, but like we're gonna get a lot of more like comedy centric Robin in this. World According to Garp was like the first like attempt at like, let's try putting Robin in a serious role. Robin. Doesn't pan out well for him. So it's going to be until, honestly, I really want to say Dead Poets Society.
Good Morning Vietnam, I would say counts.
He's still like comedic though.
Well, that's kind of the magic of Good Morning Vietnam, which
we'll talk about that. Yes, I know where you're going with.
Half of Good Morning Vietnam is him doing comedy bits and the other half is him... realizing that the Vietnam War is a bad thing.
Let's table that because that's such a very... Good Morning Vietnam is like the pivotal movie in his career that will...
It's the movie that sells both sides of Robin Williams.
Yes, and we'll get to that. So anyway, thank you so much. Do you have any final words, final thoughts to say?
Garp ADM. Seize the Garp. I don't know.
Seize the Darp. Garp ADM.
Garping the Garp.
And thank you all very much for listening to our episode on The World According to Garp 1980.
Yeah.
If you like this episode, please remember to rate, like, comment. You can comment on Spotify. We had one comment.
Comment on Spotify?
You can comment on Spotify.
That's weird.
And that's where, you know, the long take, but somebody did say in the Beetlejuice episode that we made a comment that in the first Beetlejuice, Geena Davis just says home, 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 or like Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice to go back from the model to home. Whereas in the Beetlejuice sequel, Winona says home, 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 and how I don't think that that's
world accurate. We fucked up.
Somebody did comment on that and tell us that we are incorrect on that accuracy. So to that point, comment on Spotify. We know it's the biggest platform of our listeners is between Spotify and Apple Podcast.
Don't forget the hundreds of thousands of people who have clicked on
the YouTube video
for the Thin Red Line thing. It was the movie, and then angrily comment about me.
Yes, a lot of them in Spanish. Yes, for some reason.
For all of you guys, shout out to the real ones. That's you.
But yeah, thank you very much for listening to World According to Garp. You join us next week for The Survivors.
Yes. See if we'll survive that.
See if we'll survive that one. Hey. Again, remember to rate, review, like, comment, subscribe on whatever platform you listen on. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. You can find us on, I think you can now find us on Pandora. I think you can find us on iHeartRadio.
Yeah.
You can find us on a lot of few different places, wherever you get your podcast.
Wherever you want to listen to us.
Remember to follow us at our social media. We're on Instagram, Blue Sky. We're on Threads.
We're ostensibly on Threads. We are supposedly on Threads.
Troll Team Pod. We are no longer on X. Fuck X and fuck Elon Musk. And if you have any comments or thoughts on how we should rearrange our show, you can email us
at
Marco Rubio Senate at
Rubio Senate.
You could bring, well, we're gonna bring that bit back. Fuck White Castle. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week for The Survivors.